Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks a lot for listening today. Malcolm Gladwell is with us now, the author and New Yorker magazine writer. We'll talk about his new book, David and Goliath, put it in the context of his body of work from The Tipping Point to Outliers to Blink, and take your calls in a session of Ask Malcolm Gladwell. But wait for a few minutes so that you don't have to sit on hold. I'll tell you when we're opening up the phones. The new book is called David and Goliath: Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. Malcolm Gladwell, thanks so much for doing this. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
You write that through the stories you tell in the book, you want to explore two ideas: that much of what we consider valuable in the world comes from these lopsided conflicts, and secondly, that we consistently misunderstand these kinds of encounters. So can you start by giving us your take on the actual David and Goliath story from the Bible? You think we overlook Goliath's considerable weaknesses, including perhaps a serious medical condition?
Yes. It turns out there's a very active discussion in the medical literature about whether Goliath had a condition called acromegaly. So Goliath is very, very tall, and giantism is often the result of a benign tumor on your pituitary gland, which causes an overproduction of human growth hormone. So the tallest man of all time, Robert Wadlow, had acromegaly. Some people think Abraham Lincoln had acromegaly. And it has a common side effect, which is that the tumor grows so large that it constricts the nerves going to your eye, so it causes vision problems. And if you think about Goliath that way, a lot of what's puzzling about that story of his confrontation with David starts to make sense. So why does Goliath take so long to react to the fact that David is plainly not going to engage in a sword fight, right? Yeah. Why does Goliath insist on David coming to me? Why does he lead onto the valley floor by an attendant? There's this weird thing about how he has someone almost take him by the hand and bring him to the... And the answer, what many sort of medical specialists believe, is that he had acromegaly and he probably was profoundly nearsighted. In other words, the very thing that made him so intimidating to the Israelites was his size, was also the source of his greatest weakness, that he could just barely see his hand in front of him, right? He could only, in other words, fight in close combat and was acutely vulnerable to someone who was going to hit him from afar with a sling.
And another thing you find puzzling in the biblical story is that when Goliath first sees David running toward him with no sword, no shield, he feels insulted when you say he should have felt terrified. Yes. Why did you pick up on that feeling of insult as it's written in the Bible?
Because he's having a weird response to the situation. That's what's interesting about the biblical story, because in his time, a sling, the weapon that David had, was one of the most devastating weapons available to armies of that time. That slingers were routinely used to defeat heavy infantry, which is what Goliath was. Slingers were known to be devastatingly accurate at distances of up to 200 yards, and a projectile thrown from a sling would have the stopping power equivalent to a 45 caliber
gun.
Revolver.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly lethal weapon. So he should have put two and two together. He shouldn't be saying, "I'm insulted. You're coming to me, you know, with just a shepherd's staff." He should be saying, "Wait a minute.
Slingshot
yes.
with rock.
Danger ahead." Yes.
So do you think the writers of the Bible told the David and Goliath story wrong, or that most people who read it don't see what they're getting at?
No, they don't. There's tons of fascinating stuff about this story. And in the theological literature, there are a number of arguments that if you read the story in Hebrew, or it's something closer to the original text, you pick up on all of this. You get the sense that the writers of the story there's a big nudge and a wink, so that they are fully aware of how compromised Goliath is and fully aware of how devastating a weapon David has. We've just forgotten that the sling was this extraordinarily effective weapon. And we haven't been sufficiently attuned to the subtleties of you know, the fact that what the biblical account in the, I think in the Hebrew, they make much of how slowly Goliath moves, which is an odd thing to dwell on if you're trying to accentuate someone's, ferociousness in combat, right? If he's this indomitable warrior, why do they go out of their way to talk about how slowly he's moving and why that he has this attendant leading him down? So we think that there are elements in the original story that suggest, oh, they knew what they were talking about when they wrote that story.
Malcolm Gladwell, his new book, David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. So to take a step back, you ask, what does it take to be the person who doesn't accept the accepted order of things, like a David?
Yeah.
Do you think there are patterns that produce people like that?
There are. So I have a chapter that talks about what is it that makes someone, what are the personality traits that characterize successful entrepreneurs? And some of them are obvious. They are creative people. They're highly conscientious people. But they are also disagreeable people. And I use that word in the way that psychologists do to suggest not obnoxious, but rather people who don't require the support and the acknowledgement and the ratification of their peers in order to go forward. Most of us need our peers to approve of what we're doing in order to sort of feel justified in our behavior. Disagreeable people don't. They're indifferent to that kind of social approval. And that is incredibly important if you're going to do something radical and transformative. And I have a chapter about one of the great oncology researchers of the 20th century, a man who led the fight against childhood leukemia. And at the time he was first proposing these ideas about how to fight this deadly disease, everyone thought he was crazy. Other doctors at National Cancer Institute wouldn't work with him. He was denounced and heckled at medical meetings. He just went through this hazing process. And most of us would have folded in the face of that kind of... I mean, nobody would help him. He was at the hospital 24 hours a day ministering to these sick kids because everyone thought what he was doing was more than wrong. They thought it was barbarous that he was actually torturing the kids. Mm. And he managed to... He persisted because he's disagreeable. He doesn't require the approval of his peers in order to feel justified in what he does. That is a very rare and incredibly powerful trait. And you can make a very strong argument that many of the most successful innovators have that quality, right? They don't need the world to love them.
Another science example from the book is that the bottom third of math and science students at Harvard wind up dropping out of those courses and go toward the humanities. But the same is true at Little Hartwick College in upstate New York, where I once spent a summer, by the way.
Oh, really?
Oneonta, where even the bottom Harvard kid might be a top student, right, if he was at Hartwick College. But you say the Harvard drag the way you put it is the Harvard dregs could be Hartwick all-stars.
Yeah.
Why compare the two?
Well, so this was getting at this. I was very interested in trying to figure out, is the advantage of going to a selective school, an Ivy League school or some similar one, actually an advantage? So because I'm very interested in the book in sort of figuring out whether we have correct categories for advantage and disadvantage. So I looked at the question of persistence in science and math. The biggest problem we have in producing enough science and math majors is that about half of the kids who start out in science and math drop out in college. So the question is, who drops out? Is it kids who aren't smart enough? And the answer is no. It appears to be the kids who drop out are the kids who are falling in the sort of bottom third of their class, regardless of where they go to school, regardless of their own IQ or academic ability. So the bottom third of a science and math class at Harvard, they drop out in overwhelming numbers, even though those kids are brilliant, right? Mm-hmm. And similarly, at a more average school like Harvard is a good school, but it's not on the level of an Ivy League school. The bottom third drop out there, and so do the bottom third at East Tennessee State and all the way down the line. In other words, what happens to kids in those programs is they measure themselves against their peers in the classroom, not against the world. So the kid at Harvard feels dumb if they're in the bottom third of their class, even though by any objective measure, they are in the 99.99th percentile of humanity when it comes to science and math ability. So it's all part of an argument that says, wait a minute, maybe it's not a good idea to go to the best school you can get into. If the effect of going to a great school is that if you happen to fall into the bottom third of the class, you feel dumb even if you're not.
Uh-huh. But why is that a David and Goliath story?
Because it goes to this issue of how we misunderstand what an advantage is. Like in the Goliath story, we call Goliath the favorite because he's big and tall and strong. Why do we have such a limited understanding of advantages that says that that's an advantage, and somehow David, who is audacious, fast-moving, and highly skilled at an unconventional activity, sling, why aren't those? Why don't we call David the favorite in that battle? Why do we somehow assume that being tall and strong is an advantage, and being short and quick and audacious is not? Right. So I was very curious in writing this book to interrogate our categories of advantage and disadvantage. And so the obvious one in our contemporary society is we've all agreed that going to an elite school is the best thing that you could possibly do if you're headed off to college. And I wanted to say, well, wait a minute, maybe that's not true. Maybe there are exceptions to that. Or we can come to a more sophisticated understanding of what the appropriate strategy is.
Malcolm Gladwell, his new book, David and Goliath. And you begin part three of your book, which is called The Limits of Power, by contrasting the British Army's failures in Northern Ireland with an anti-crime program in Brownsville, Brooklyn. So can you tell us the story first of Brooklyn activist Rosemary Lawler and why you included it?
Well, the Brooklyn story is a story about how the NYPD, actually the housing police at NYPD, led by a woman, a really remarkable woman named Joanne Jaffe, has had extraordinary success against crime in the projects in places like Brownsville and Harlem by adopting a very, very different policing strategy, by layering on top of sort of conventional policing, a whole degree of what I call in the book, legitimacy strategies. In other words, they understood that if you go into the most difficult neighborhoods in this city, the police, the NYPD, has a legitimacy problem. They are not perceived as being as legitimately representing legitimate authority in those neighborhoods. So what she did was, she said, Joanne Jaffe said, I'm going to reestablish my legitimacy in the eyes of the community I'm trying to police. And so she identified the kids who were juvenile delinquents and most at risk for that kind of activity. And in addition to monitoring them and telling them, listen, you can't screw up anymore, she also befriended them and made friends with their family and enrolled them in after-school programs and had the cops play basketball with them and tried to find them summer jobs, all the kinds of things that we associate with kind of, you know, ridiculous, you know, bleeding heart liberal approach to social policy. Mm-hmm. With the effect, by the way, that the crime rate among in those neighborhoods has plunged. I mean, in the housing projects, numbers on things like muggings are down dramatically as a result of the strategy followed by the housing police in those areas. So it works. Right. So this question, and this question of legitimacy is, I think, at the core of a lot of battles between authority and insurgency. If you think about juvenile delinquents as kind of junior insurgents, right, the people who refuse to accept the authority of the society in which they're living.
So I thought that this was going to be the segment of the show where we don't talk about the mayoral race.
Yes.
But do you think that that story suggests a challenge for the next mayor, whoever he is, after Stop and Frisk?
Well, I think that there's a lot to be... I think that the success of the housing police and Joanne Jaffe in these areas of Brownsville and Harlem suggests there is an alternate strategy available to the NYPD in general. What she's arguing is that traditional policing married with a concerted attempt to restore the legitimacy of police authority in troubled neighborhoods is the most effective way to bring down crime. So to the extent that stop and frisk harms the perceived legitimacy of the police, it's a problem. Now, that doesn't mean it's all I think this is a very, very complicated issue, and I feel there's I'm not saying that all stop and frisk activities are as a result problematic. I'm saying that you shouldn't, you should never pursue any strategy that causes the authority of the police to be called into question, the legitimacy of the police to be called into question. And legitimacy is about, there's been a lot of work by psychologists on legitimacy in recent years. Legitimacy is about fairness, it's about consistency, and it's about voice. People perceive authority as legitimate when they feel they can speak up and be heard, when they feel they're not being treated differently than other people, and when they feel like policy is, towards them is not going to change radically tomorrow or the day after that. Joanne Jaffe went out of her way to address those three concerns in places like Brownsville with extraordinary results. I use the example of the British in Northern Ireland to say the reason that a flurry of rebellious behavior in 1968 in Northern Ireland turned into 30 years of conflict was the British Army didn't understand this principle of legitimacy. They didn't understand that it was not enough to go in and crack down. You had to make sure that all parties to the conflict perceived your intervention as legitimate, right? You could not be perceived as favoring one side over another. You could not be perceived as being arbitrary or as not listening to people's needs and desires.
I knew you'd get back to the British Army in Northern Ireland somehow, yes. And you did. So, listeners, coming up in a few minutes, it's Ask Malcolm Gladwell. You can start calling now, ask about any of the ideas we've been discussing from his new book, David and Goliath, or something that has affected you or that you've perhaps had a question about from his earlier books, like The Tipping Point or Outliers or Blink. Ask Malcolm Gladwell at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Maybe you have a question about the 10,000 hours theory or the talent myth or the role of the stickiness factor in social epidemics. Or maybe you read something that he wrote sort of in defense of Lance Armstrong or something from his other sports-related writing on Grantland.com. Ask Malcolm Gladwell at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Malcolm, let me get the ball rolling on that by seeing how you would relate David and Goliath to your book, Outliers, because yeah. there you focused on the context of people's upbringings mm-hmm. and idiosyncrasies as mm-hmm. determinants of becoming extremely successful. Mm-hmm. Does your study of the Davids, the underdogs, give you insights that build on what you learned from studying the Outliers?
Yeah, the Outliers was a kind of view from 10,000 feet. It was, are there kind of broad rules we can observe in principles, in the success of groups. So it's, you know, I talked about Jewish lawyers in New York. I talked about West Indians, light-skinned Jamaicans in the West Indies. I talked about, you know, all kinds of these sort of Korean pilots and Asian kids in mathematics and all these sorts of very general questions. This book is much more personal. It's very much about individual people's lives. Each chapter is about a person who has gone through some kind of experience. So it's this is the last one was from on high, and this one is up close.
How do you view your own success in your own models? I mean, the wild success of The Tipping Point, which I think really put you on the map in the mid-90s, was an example of, you know, some good content catching the right wave and becoming iconically big. Do you see yourself as a David, as a 10,000 hours practice person, as yeah. a product of good parents or of underdog Canada? Can you get a little Gladwellian about Malcolm Gladwell?
Well, I definitely got my 10,000 hours in. I spent 10 years at the Washington Post where, and when I started, I knew nothing about how to do journalism, and by the end, I think I knew a fair amount. So I had the benefit of an extraordinary apprenticeship at a great journalistic institution, and nothing would have happened without that. I think I benefited by being a Canadian in America. I think immigrants have a certain perspective. You know, we see things a little differently, which is really helpful if you're going to be a journalist. So things that would seem commonplace to someone who lives here are interesting to me because I've written a lot about race over the last 10 years, 15 years. And that's because I grew up in a little tiny town in southwestern Ontario where race was just not an issue. We never discussed it, even though my mother is black and no one brought it up. And then I came to America and it seemed like every second conversation was about race. And it was fascinating to me. I still return to this subject because to see it as an outsider is incredibly interesting.
You wrote The Tipping Point, which is really about social networks, years before anything we would call a social network like Facebook and Twitter. And really, if that book came out in 96, what we think of as the modern internet really debuted in 95. So you must have written most of The Tipping Point before there was the internet as we think of it, which is our modern context for all social networking. So with all of these years of hindsight now, do you think the internet has just, played into pre-existing concepts about social networking that you were already writing about? Or would you revise any of your thinking on that?
Well, it would definitely be, if I rewrote The Tipping Point today, I'd have to talk about the internet a lot. There's no doubt about that. I sort of think, it's an interesting, really interesting question. I sort of think that what the internet does is it magnifies existing patterns of social interaction. It also creates some new ones, but I think a lot of what it's doing is magnifying. The people who are most socially connected in face-to-face communication are also, in my experience, the ones who are most socially influential online, that they simply take their skills and gifts and social power and transfer it onto this new domain. And with the result, they can now reach, some multiple of the people they could reach in the past. I tend to be someone who thinks that technology does not radically transform the nature of social interaction. What it does is it augments and accentuates it.
Malcolm Gladwell, his new book is David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. We'll take a break and then continue with your calls. For Malcolm Gladwell on anything that you've read of his or anything that he's saying here today about David and Goliath or anything else, ask Malcolm Gladwell. Our lines are full, but as people finish up, you can call 212-433-WNYC, or you can tweet at Brian Lehrer, post to our Facebook page at Brian Lehrer, or on our comments page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Stay with us. WNYC with journalist, author, sports blogger, New Yorker correspondent, Malcolm Gladwell. His new book is David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. And you can ask him about that or any of his prior work. And let's start with Denise in Brooklyn. Denise, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, Brian. Thank you. Malcolm Gladwell, it's a pleasure to be able to speak with you. I wanted to know that the first piece I've read of yours was in 1996, the piece you wrote, Black Like Them.
Oh, yes.
and from then, I've followed your work. So thanks for being on. And I'd like to ask you, how does contrarianism, being contrary, how does that fit into your premise of the underdog characteristic?
Yeah, that's a, the notion of disagreeablesness is about, in a certain sense, about contrariness. The contrarian is someone who does not value the conventional wisdom, right? Who doesn't think that because everyone thinks a certain way, they have to think that way. That is an absolutely necessary component of any kind of transformative, disruptive innovation. It's amazing, you know, to go back and look at the history of innovations, and but look not at the kind of technological history, which is what we normally do, but look at the social history of them. And, you know, it's the same story again and again and again. Everyone thinks it's crazy except for three people, and then it turns out that they're right, right? There's that, and I think we kind of sometimes overlook just how hard it is to be one of those three people who is insisting on a radical change in the way things are done. It's insanely hard to be truly contrary.
Jess in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jess.
Hi, Malcolm Gladwell. I love your work. You know, you translate academic research for the everyday person, and it's such a vital role. Two questions. I'm sure you would agree that the vast majority of people who represent the underdog are women. Mm-hmm. And I really hope that over 50% of the people that you profile in this book are women. And while we're on the topic of that, I found it to be really surprising with Outliers, which I loved, mm-hmm. That you don't feature any women, yet it was your mother that helped you get to where you were.
Yeah.
So I really hope your upcoming edition with Outliers would add a woman to the story.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I was, after the fact, so mortified by the lack of women in Outliers, particularly since, as you say, the story ends with me talking about how my mother is the kind of the quintessential example of what I was writing about. This book is more than, I think, half of the chapters have as their central character a woman. Actually, the talk I'm giving at the New Yorker Festival this weekend is about something that's not in the book, but also about the idea of women as tokens, how women get pushed into the role of a token, and that impedes their progress. So it's something that is absolutely, you're absolutely right. I think that this doing this book has awakened me once again to the difficulties that women face in many professions.
So here's a story in the book that's about a woman, Teresa de Brito, which was not to my eyes such an obvious David and Goliath story. Maybe you can explain how it is. Mm-hmm. And in fact, will probably enrage many parents and teachers listening right now. It's your chapter on why smaller class size does mm-hmm. not always produce better outcomes for the students, like a class with 29 kids that your subject taught was more successful than one with 12. Why did you revisit this question in a way that portrayed small class size as the Goliath?
Well, small class size is the Goliath because it is the option that is available to the people with the most resources, right? And we pursue that option in the belief that we are creating an advantage for our children. And my argument is that the picture is a lot more complicated than that, that when you have a very large class and you make it smaller, things get better for the kids. But there is a point at which smaller classes do not produce better outcomes. They appear to produce worse outcomes. And you said this will enrage many teachers. I don't think it will, because I got this idea from teachers. I went out and talked to countless teachers, asking them, is there an optimal class size? Is there a point at which a class can be too small? And they said, absolutely, there's a point where it gets too small. Now, they all have different definitions, slightly different, of what that point is. But it does seem like I found it hard to find particularly middle and high school teachers who thought that it was a good idea to have a class in the mid-teens. They thought it gets really problematic when you get down to...
Because?
For a number of reasons. One is that it's really hard, particularly with adolescents, to get any discussion going when the room's too small. And when you do get discussion going, it's very, very limited. There isn't a diversity of voices in the room. Two, that paradoxically, you can have real behavioral problems in small classes because one bad actor can dominate, or one conflict between two kids can dominate because there's nowhere for them to hide. But the most important reason, and there's some really interesting academic research on this, is that when a class gets too small, it starts to harm the poorest students. They get singled out And but more importantly, the thing that a kid who's struggling needs, if he or she is to make headway, is to find a true peer, to find someone else who has the same problems they have, who is learning at the same pace, who's asking the same questions, so they don't feel isolated and alone at the bottom. When classes get too small, the poorest students feel isolated and alone at the bottom. And that's devastating, right? And that's a big, so many teachers said this to me. You don't want to have your poorest kid marooned there in a class where they're singled out as the struggling one. You can't hide in a class like that gets too small.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Of course, if you can hide, then you can also hide the fact that you're not keeping up and get lost that way. And I guess in New York City, the standard today is, I think it's 33 in middle and high school. So even your big class size example of 29 was smaller by 4 students.
I would not say it is clearly the case that when you're in the 30s, you do better by making your classes smaller. I mean, I'm not talking about New York City, 33 kids at all here. I'm talking about 25 to and below.
Judy in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Malcolm Gladwell. Hi.
Hi. You're both American treasures. Between your heart and your intelligence, I just adore both of you. And that's the first thing. Second, I wanted to say, this is just a little aside, I almost fell out of bed the other night listening to, it ended up being Malcolm Gladwell on The Moth with the singing about the new wife in the wedding reception story.
I have a sideline, yes.
Oh my gosh, when they said it was you, I just cracked up. But on the serious note, what I wanted to talk about is I noticed in one of your books, I'm sorry, I'm not exactly sure which one, it was only about a page, and you talked about young people, mainly troubled male adolescents, and that they derive their cultures from each other, that most of what the predominant culture is sending as a message to them or what their elders are trying to transfer to them is not getting through because they're listening to each other. And I think it was said in your book in terms of violence, and I think about that all the time with these school shootings. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you have thought more about it, if you, I'm thinking, well, it's too bad we can't not have it in the press so that the kids don't get the ideas from each other, but that would never work. Have you thought more about this in subsequent shootings?
Yeah, I have thought a lot about this. It's a very interesting question. What we are seeing right now with these mass shootings in the United States is a classic example of an epidemic. It is a contagious pathology, and there have been numerous examples through societies of all types through the years of this kind of contagious pathology. I wrote in The Tipping Point about contagions of suicides. Right, the social dynamics of that are the same as this: people who are damaged take their cues from what they see going on around them, and they ape these kind of deeply problematic patterns of behavior. What do you do when you're in the middle of one of these epidemics? You have to somehow stop the pattern of contagion. You said that one approach would be not to write about it, but that will never happen. I wonder, is there some way we could make it happen? Imagine just as a thought experiment that we had the equivalent of a rape shield law when it comes to mass shootings. So we have reached a consensus in society that when a woman is raped, we do not release the identity of the victim. So we have accepted a constraint on freedom of the press because there's a higher value here, which is the dignity of the person who has been subjected to this crime. So we've already shown we can do this. So why can't we say, when it comes to these mass shootings, here's what we're going to do. We are not going to talk about the individual who committed the atrocity. We're not going to mention who he is, where he comes from, what he's like, what was going through his head. In other words, if some sick person out there thinks they can get some kind of weird notoriety from doing this, we're going to deny them that chance. I think we could do that. I honestly don't think it's impossible. We're not so... This problem is so terrifying and is growing so large, we have to start thinking about more dramatic answers that's how you deal with epidemics. You have to be much more creative in your approach to solving them.
Malcolm Gladwell, my guest on WNYC. His new book is called David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. We're taking your questions on that or anything from his body of work. And let's get to a couple of your critics. Mm-hmm. Dan Kay from Park Slope on our comments page. Can you ask him why he appears to be on a constant crusade against people who have achieved great things? I think this is about your notion of the talent myth. If you look at his research through that lens, he writes, you have to believe he looks for evidence to confirm his bias instead of applying common sense to the fact that there simply are great geniuses who have worked hard for their station and should be emulated, not reduced. What do you say to Dan Kay from Park Slope?
Oh, I didn't know that I've ever said that. I thought my books have been celebrations of exceptional individuals. Certainly the current book is a lot about understanding what is remarkable about, I mean, the chapter on Emil Freireich, this legendary cancer researcher who is a one in a million guy. And I talk about why he's a one in a million guy.
But in Outliers, there is sort of a lot of, you know, you didn't build that to recall the 2012 presidential race. A lot about context of how people came up and stuff like that.
But that, remember, that is, at no point in that book do I say that individual talent doesn't matter. I'm just trying to put it in context. So I have a long thing about the Beatles. I make it absolutely clear that the Beatles are, you know, four insanely talented people, huge amount of ability there. But that doesn't tell you the whole story. And it's fascinating to sort of say, what are the circumstances that allow talent to be expressed? And that was the Outliers was about understanding the circumstances that permit ability to come forth. So I think it's fairer to understand Outliers as simply a response to those who think that genius is sufficient. Mm-hmm. And I think it's not sufficient.
Another critic, I think, Philip in Madison, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hi, Philip.
Hi. I appreciate the opportunity to present my questions, which basically is the following. Mr. Gladwell, obviously a very intelligent person, has received much criticism by book reviewers for his current book and his prior books. That doesn't resolve the debate of whether he's correct or not, but I think given that it's a repeated event in book reviews of his various books, I find it disappointing that that isn't part of the subject matter of the interview. You're obviously...
But it is. That's why I took your call.
We're doing it right now.
We're doing it right now is the answer. Okay. And I will tell you, Philip, that I think, as you can hear from our other callers, that Malcolm has inspired so many people to think creatively about so many things that I didn't think it would be, do the most service to the most people to just focus on the criticisms of his work primarily. But we're focusing on them in part. So do you want to make one in particular? Is there one that sticks with you?
I wasn't expecting this opportunity, and I don't have.
I know what you're talking about. I get one. The most consistent criticism I get comes typically from academics, who disagree with the way I use academic research, and their disagreement is honest, and it comes from a difference in our perspectives. They are used to surveying an entire literature, representing all of the different sides of it, and making some kind of analytical contribution in that way, right? So in other words, they engage the full complexity of any particular, or at least they hope to, of any particular field. I don't do that. What I do is I am a storyteller, and I look to academic research for ways of explaining or understanding or augmenting the story I'm telling. The reason I don't do things their way is that their way has a cost, and that is it makes their writing inaccessible. If you've ever sat down and tried to read the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, and you're not a PhD in psychology, it's pretty rough going, right? If you're someone who has as their goal to reach a lay audience with ideas they would never otherwise, might not otherwise be exposed to, you can't do it their way. So, I mean, I get frustrated sometimes, although I understand where they're coming from. I get frustrated because I don't think they fully, my academic critics, and it's not all academics, it's only a small number. I don't think they fully appreciate that I am engaged in a fundamentally different process than they are.
But if there is a risk in the job of being a popularizer, which is that you can take anecdotes and leave the impression that you're overgeneralizing from the examples to very consistent truths when they may not be as either scientifically valid or just simply consistent as some of the stories in David and Goliath, for example, might suggest, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think that's true of all journalism. I think it's true of all storytelling. I think it is impossible at any moment to give some kind of a completely rigorous and inclusive account of the way we think about something. I mean, I think readers, look, when I talk to my readers, I'm always struck by the sophistication and intelligence with which they approach my work and the work of people like me. I mean, I don't think people are thinking this is, no one's confusing me with Moses bringing the tablets down from the mountain, right? And so I think we should keep that in mind.
But maybe David or Goliath. And so we'll take one last question on that. Kathy in Beacon, you're on WNYC with Malcolm Gladwell. Hi.
Hi, thank you. I am sorry to say, unless it's been in The New Yorker, I haven't read any of your work, but I'm going to now. My issue is your idea about David and Goliath. We have some Goliaths that seem absolutely undefeatable, like the Koch brothers and Monsanto. Mm-hmm. Monsanto especially really bothers me because they've sued over 3,000 or 4,000 small farmers and sued them out of business and gotten away with it. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand your argument in terms of this, because I'm a David. I'm constantly pushing rocks up hills, and I don't feel like we have any power over. I feel that Monsanto is a very bad corporation. And
so, Kathy, I'm going to leave it there because we've got like 45 seconds left. So in the context of citizen versus corporation in 21st century America, does the book have a lesson?
I think there are lessons to be found in my book for that. I mean, I think it's important to say that David doesn't win all the time against Goliath. I mean, that you can only, there are only certain battles that can be won. But my argument in my book is that there is more hope for the Davids in the world than we normally assume, that it's not as bleak a picture as it can sometimes seem. And hopefully people can find some sustenance and insight from that.
And including in the weaknesses of Monsanto that may be endemic to their position that you haven't yet found. That's one of the things I would take from it. So David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants, the new book from Malcolm Gladwell, who's going to be at the New Yorker Festival on Saturday. Is that right? Saturday?
Sunday morning
at the New Yorker Festival, in case you want to buy tickets for that. Thank you. This has been so much fun. I really appreciate how much time you gave us today.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.